This is Vishal Tobaccowala, author of Restoring the Soul of Business, Staying Human in the Age of Data, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which was named by Forbes as one of 11 smart podcasts that will keep you in the know, and named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. My goal for this podcast is to help us both keep up with the latest ideas in the quickly changing fields of modern marketing and sales. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or some other helpful resource that I know of for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat and I'll try to point you in the right direction and save you some time. This show is a labor of love that I do in my spare time. My day job is running a marketing agency where we work with manufacturers and industrial companies to arm their sales teams to take back control of their company's growth. We're not a fit for every company, but if that sounds like you, check out salesartillery.com. And now, on with the show. Today, we welcome Rashad Tobaccowala to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about his book, Restoring the Soul of Business, Staying Human in the Age of Data, published by HarperCollins. And now, rather than reading his bio, I want to read an excerpt about Rashad from his book. Lest you think I'm an anti-tech zealot who believes we should go back to a kindler, gentler analog time, let me tell you about myself. I grew up in Bombay, India, receiving a degree in economics and advanced mathematics from the University of Bombay. I then came to the United States and received an MBA in marketing and finance from one of the most quantitative schools in the world, the University of Chicago. Over a 37-year career at the companies of the Publicis Group, an 80,000-person global marketing and business transformation firm, I helped found or co-found some of the first digital agencies and future-oriented strategic consultancies, as well as contributing to the shaping and growth of one of the two largest buyers of digital data-driven media in the world. I've served as chairman of major global digital and e-commerce-oriented firms such as Digitas for Publicis and served as a chief strategist and chief growth officer for Publicis Group while also serving as a trusted advisor to many of our clients' reinventions and reimaginings. I relate this short story to establish my credentials in the data-driven digital space. I'm obviously someone who believes in digital change. Not so obviously, I also believe in the power of people to make transformations work. As much as I value data, devices, and software, I value empathy, innovation, and relationships. My career has been about change, seeing it, managing it, and adapting to it. Change requires adopting the latest technology, but it also requires maximizing the best qualities of people. My career has also been about reinvention, reinventing companies as well as myself. Reinvention involves implementing state-of-the-art software and digital processes that produce something new, but it also involves getting people to embrace the new and enhance it with their ideas and actions. I've led transformation efforts both in the U.S. and in countries throughout the world and earned a reputation as a digital pioneer while also being known as someone who has helped inspire and grow talent. The two roles are not incompatible. Rashad, congratulations on Restoring the Soul of Business and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be here.
So this book, I first learned about it because it was recommended by one of your fellow alumni of the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, Ted Wright, the author of Fizz.
Yes.
And he's been on the Marketing Book Podcast, and I read with great interest how you started out your career at Leo Burnett in Chicago, which is part of Publicis, and I just had really warm feelings because after I got out of the Army and I got an MBA, I started interviewing at big agencies, and I interviewed at that building in 1988, and I was so excited about the idea of working there and moving to Chicago, but as fate would have it, I ended up going off to New York. So as you talked about the old building and the new building, it was so interesting to hear about your story at Leo Burnett, which I've always found so interesting and followed very closely.
Thank you.
So the other thing I have to mention, Rashad, is that as I was reading the book, the song by Sam and Dave, Soul Man, it kept going through my head. And so it occurred to me that, you know, I don't want to offer too much unsolicited, career advice, particularly to a guy like you, but when you do all these keynotes around the world, you know, your walk-on music, if you have it, maybe it could be Soul Man by Sam and Dave.
I think that is correct. I will definitely keep that in mind. And, you know, these days, anything that lets you stand out is helpful. So that one works.
Great. So let me just read one other quick excerpt from the book and get into some of these questions. You write, "Time is all we have. So why should you allocate a part of your most precious asset on engaging with this book? Because my hope is that it will leave you seeing, thinking, and feeling differently about how to grow and remain relevant in transformative times. How to grow yourself, grow those around you, and grow your practice, passion, or company. How to remain relevant by understanding what it takes to make sense and thrive in a world of rapid technological, demographic, and global upheaval. And it will do so by questioning much of what business takes for granted, why data is often not the way forward, and we may have too much of it, why change sucks, why having more rather than fewer meetings is better, and why it's essential to have a culture and courage that calls out the turd on the table. You will not only learn what makes great leaders, but also how to deal with it or not become a bad boss. You'll discover how to extract meaning from data and see poetry in the plumbing. This book recognizes that while our world is increasingly filled with digital, silicon-based computing objects, it's populated by people who remain analog, carbon-based, feeling creatures. People like you and me. Companies can choose to upgrade the skills of their people and reimagine the way they work, or swap out their people and acquire new ways of thinking. Often both are necessary. This book is about upgrading the operating systems of people and companies by remembering the thinking and feeling component of the operating system. A central premise is that successful individuals and firms can never forget the importance of people, their emotions, the culture of the organization, and what cannot be measured. I refer to this as the soul of a company. This soul is critical, even as individuals and firms reinvent themselves for an increasingly AI-augmented, data-driven, networked, and distributed screen-based future." So, Rashad, you talk about, as the world becomes more data-driven and real-time, and as financial markets punish companies for failing to meet their goals, you worry that our short-term focus on numbers is destroying the long-term health of businesses. How so?
What we are doing is, because of both a prevalence of data and a emphasis on both the short-term and stock prices, we are running companies increasingly using a spreadsheet, which is we're running companies looking at the scorecard versus looking at the business we're in, which is the ball, or the talent, which is the player, or the spectators, which is the customer. We're just emphasizing the scoreboard. And as a result, we begin to make decisions which come to haunt us. For example, if you basically believe that it's numbers that matter, and you're a bank, you basically incentivize everyone to open as many bank accounts as you possibly can. And once they figure out that that's the way forward, and you look the other way on how they do it, you end up with a little bank called Wells Fargo. And Wells Fargo has its third CEO in 4 years, has lost billions of dollars in market cap, has had to pay $3 to $4 billion back to the government, because for them, it was all about the numbers. But it doesn't even have to be a bank. You could basically say, we have to ship this plane regardless of what happens. We must ship this plane because we need the revenue and we need to beat Airbus. And you have something called Boeing, 737 MAX. So on the other hand, you look at companies that only focus on the story and do not focus on the spreadsheet, that basically say, you know what? We don't care about data. We're going to tell this amazing visionary story about the future. And then you have a company called WeWork, right? which basically is bullshit adorned with beer as a business model.
Mm-hmm. And their IPO crashed, as I recall.
Yes. Well, they claimed that they were a $60 billion company. That's a $5 billion company. And somewhere along the way, by the way, they convinced companies like JP Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs to value them at that level, which basically says, were these people looking at anything but the numbers, both the incentives or the commission that they were going to get and how they were going to make money, versus focusing on potential investors that would have lost a lot of money and basically making up total nonsense. So that's what I basically say. We have basically become a spreadsheet-oriented culture because data is what we live by. And at the very same time, 56% of all employees are disengaged. And you make short-term decisions like saying, let's go to open seating so we can save space. And guess what happens? The number of emails goes up by 50 to 100% in an organization, and turnover rises by 5 to 10%. Any money that you saved, you lost in productivity and in turnover. But you could measure the real estate savings. You could not measure anything else. So what I basically tell people is too much math, too little meaning. Successful businesses need to combine the story and the spreadsheet.
So yes, you talk about how data is so seductive and dangerous. But let me ask you, what do you mean when you urge readers to ask questions data can answer, not data-driven questions?
So for instance, we now begin to have a habit because of things like algorithms to look for answers in streams of data. We sometimes believe that if there is a lot of data emanating from a place, and today, because there is so much data, both from an organization, social data, mobile data, we then basically try to say, what does this data tell us? Instead, often the data isn't telling you much, or it isn't telling you anything that is particularly meaningful. For instance, if you look at where I go and the time I spend at different places, if you track my mobile phone, and you think that that's going to tell you what is important to me and my life, it may probably not, because you will find me either at work, or you will find me at a coffee shop, or you will find me at home. But maybe what's important to my life is basically going out on a walk with my wife or meeting in a restaurant with my kids, which occurs only once in a while and has little time. So the question should have been, should we basically find out from Rashad what is important from his life, or should we look at the data and figure out where he spends the most time and believe that is the most important thing in his life? So my stuff simply is, ask the question that data can answer. Don't let data answer the question.
Right. So let's talk about what you talk about in the book, which is the dark side of our world of bright screens. And I say that as I'm looking at a screen right now. Remind listeners what we gain and lose in a screen-dominated workplace.
So in a screen-dominated workplace, we gain a lot of things. The first thing that we gain is we gain the possibility of being involved and at work when, because of constraints, we cannot. Now, until recently, the constraints were you had to look after a kid, you were out of town, you couldn't get to work. Today, obviously, those constraints include the fact that we have, as we speak today, a coronavirus issue, which is making people work from home. Second is it basically allows companies to incorporate people both internationally and other people who cannot necessarily travel into it. So it brings in more diversity. So one, it gives you flexibility. The second is brings you diversity. And the third, it often saves time and costs because someone doesn't have to fly across the world for a meeting or somewhere in a big way. So in about an hour after this podcast, I will be speaking to the management board of the Effie Awards, you know, which is the Effectiveness Awards.
Yes.
So they're basically having a gathering, and they get an outside speaker to come to New York City and speak to them once in a while. And this time, I was the selected speaker. But because of the coronavirus, as well as because all my other New York meetings were canceled, I asked if I could video in my conversation versus being there physically. And they said, absolutely, completely understand. We have some other people who are not allowed to travel and therefore will be also dialing in. So that gives me an amazing new world. So all of these things are fantastic. Mm-hmm. The downsides are a few. The first is, if you only interact with people using screens and you don't think about other things, it's very hard to basically build relationships. And to a certain extent, it makes people unequal. So for instance, if you only see someone on a screen and you've never met them in person, and sometimes they're on the screen and sometimes you're on audio, you don't see things like tone of voice. You don't have a relationship because everything is talked about in words. You don't have sidebar conversations. And so sometimes things can be misinterpreted, etc. So today I was reading an interview with a gentleman who runs Automattic, you know, the company that produces WordPress, among other things. And he has, I believe, over 1,500 employees distributed around the world. And among the things that he does to make them feel inclusive is, if a single person dials in on video, every single other person has to dial in on video too.
Oh, that's a great idea.
So everybody is equal. So you could have three people in a conference room and one person dialing in on video. Those three people in the conference room have to pull out their laptops and also dial into video. That's number one. Number two is, every employee, when they have a special anniversary, birthday, etc., the company ships to them cupcakes or cakes or whatever it is to celebrate. Third is, every employee is given a $250 budget a year or $250 budget a month to spend on whatever they believe is necessary, including going and getting a room at WeWork or whatever it is. So all of these things try to get people to recognize, A, that you can't work completely alone. Second is, when you work together, you don't want to be outside as the one on the screen. And third is, how do you create some form of relationships and don't just be focused on the screen? Because in Matter, not only is the problem with the screens, but there's another problem with screens, which is, the modern screen in a conference room is the modern fireplace that we all gaze at. We don't gaze at each other. We don't talk to each other. We look at these numbers, some of us looking at phones, others looking at something else. And so I say, you know what, it would be really good to occasionally have a meeting when there are no screens. Or, like, if you and I talk to each other, we don't point at screens. We just look at each other's ugly faces.
Yeah, speak for yourself. No, I'm kidding. You're absolutely right. Yes, it's so interesting. And it seems that so many companies don't think about what's, the human side, which is why you wrote this book. And it points out some of those really obvious things that I just think people and companies are missing. So let's talk about what listeners should understand about workers' quest for meaning in the modern workplace. You know, it seems like so many organizations are thinking, they're lucky to have a job, but they seem to be missing it. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that and about talent in a bit. But what should listeners understand about workers and their yearning for meaning?
So when I wrote this book, one of the key things that I did was, I wanted to write a book that was broader than a book on advertising or marketing. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to write a book that was broader than my own lived experience or my own things that I had seen over 38 years around the world, which were both very broad, but I didn't think that was enough. So I actually, working with my management, took half time off for a year just to do research about the various topics I was writing about. So therefore, the book is much broader, as Ken Auletta, who's written the foreword, says. It's more a book of business than a book of wisdom. And in that, one of the key questions I was asking, and I came across this number from Towers Perrin, which is a consulting company, that 56% of employees are not engaged at work. This is across industries.
Engaged means, how did they determine that?
So basically, people say, do you find satisfaction at work? Do you believe that all your abilities are being used? Do you believe that you're actually doing anything more than doing the minimum necessary to keep your job.
Mm.
Okay. So the idea is I'll work as hard as possible in order not to be fired, but I will not basically bring my quote unquote soul to this. I'm just going to bring my body and the minimum necessary of my heart and mind in order to me to get the money.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
And part of the reason is that we at companies, you know, as we are focusing on the spreadsheet, as we are focusing on the stock price, we aren't focusing enough on the talent, and they can see that and they can feel that. They see themselves as nothing but sort of, you know, input units, right? Mm-hmm. How do we make as much output from these input units while feeding them the very little? So think about me as a cow. How do I give this cow the smallest space possible to sit? How do I give them the least amount of grass I can? And how can I milk and pump out as much milk as possible?
Great analogy.
Okay. And so obviously you tend to be a disengaged cow when you come into this. And then sometimes what you basically say is, and some of us work for these three things, which are important, by the way. So I believe they are important. One of them is money, which I believe is extremely important because you need it. The second is recognition / fame, which is very important for work. And the third thing that people are sort of, you know, looking for is power, right? And if you're very senior, you tend to have lots of money, fame, and power. If you're a junior in an organization, you at least want to get paid decently. Once in a while, you'd like to be recognized. You probably don't have much power outside of outside windows that you can slam the phone down on. Okay, right. But otherwise, not much. But while those are important, those are not enough. And what tends to happen is most organizations can't give you enough money, fame, and power. They have to give you enough money for you to stay and keep in a job. But there were three other things that I found that takes people from disengaged to engaged. One of them is growth, which is, can they grow? Can they grow both as a person? Can they grow their skills? Can you give me something that'll make me more competent both inside and outside the company? Can I learn? That mm-hmm. is very, very important. That gets me engaged. It gets me engaged because A, it's challenging. B, it's something that I can take with me if I leave the company. So I'll get engaged even in this company because, oh my God, I can take it outside the company. The second one, which is extremely important besides growth, is purpose and values, which is sometimes you can have a very well-paid person who really doesn't believe in the purpose or values of the company, which is they come in, you know, it might basically be a company that is, you know, harming people, or it's a company that is polluting the environment, but it is a company that pays well enough. And so the person basically comes in and does it for the pay, but really says, you know, I don't like telling people I work at this company, or I often, when people question me, I kind of wonder, what am I doing here? Okay.
I think there's probably some listeners that can relate to that.
Which is the second part of it. And the third one is connection. So growth is important. Purpose and meaning of your company or values of the company is important. And third is connections. And that is basically the people around you. Do you feel that you can learn and grow and, you know, you're surrounded by, you know, some decent colleagues, your boss is actually an acceptable human being versus some indecent character, right? And if you've got people reporting to you, whether you have some control over who they are and whether you can build them. And if you notice, those other three don't cost as much and aren't as cynical. When you're thinking about personal growth, when you're thinking about connecting to people and purpose and values of the company, you think outside yourself. When you think about money, purpose, and power, you think only inside yourself.
Yes. So your book speaks to, you know, really smart people, but it also had things in it for a knucklehead like me. And in the book, you have 7 key concepts for staying human, you know, for an employee, but also more importantly for running a company. And what I want to talk about now is something I mentioned very quickly earlier on, and that's turds. I want to talk to you, Rashad Tabakawala, about turds.
Yes.
Thank you for including something that would, you know, definitely catch my attention. Why is it important to talk about what you call the turd on the table?
The reason it's very important to talk about the turn on the table is for two reasons. The first is we gather too many times in meetings and we look at the table and we see something moist and brown and we all pretend it's a brownie when it's a piece of shit.
Yeah, I think I've been in meetings like that.
And what we do is because either of the culture and the company that we are at or because of bosses who would cut off our necks if we basically said, hey, this ain't a brownie, this is a turd. We basically sort of go on. And the turd can be of various sorts. A turd can be, hey, look, we're not discussing the real issue here. A turd can be your boss is doing something that is not correct, either harassing people or doing something not correct, as you saw with the Weinstein Company, mm-hmm. where clearly you had a person who was really a horrible human being, but nobody called him out, or a few people called him out and were bored off, right? Or there are rules that basically you know are taking shortcuts and potentially destroying the company, like a Boeing or a Wells Fargo, which I mentioned earlier. And therefore, unless you can speak truth to power, you have three big issues which companies keep celebrating. But if you cannot speak truth to power, that's all they'll be doing. They'll be celebrating in theory, but never be able to celebrate in practice. What are those three things? The first is, if you are afraid of speaking up, what is very likely is that place cannot be an innovative place. Because innovation means making new connections, being somewhat fearless, being creative, and taking risks. And part of the turn on the table is basically to challenge the status quo. So if you have a culture that punishes you, you can't be innovative. That's number one. The second is it's highly unlikely that you will be able to attract world-class talent. Because world-class talent has options. And if they find an environment where they aren't allowed to speak up, that's going to be a problem. The third and most importantly is it's very likely that a company is going to find itself heading like a ship towards the rock and nobody basically says, hey, listen, we are going to hit the iceberg and we are on the Titanic. Because if you say so, they throw you off the Titanic, mm-hmm. right? When you could for many years or many months ahead or many days ahead say, hey, listen, yes, you can throw me off, but all of us are going to basically go down under unless we understand this. But the reason why much management talks about we are open, innovative, and we're looking for ideas, but that does not happen is because when somebody speaks up, management either punishes them or makes them lose their job or makes fun of them. And therefore, people basically keep quiet. And my belief is unless you can speak about the turn on the table, you just are going to basically find yourself not necessarily munching on that, but you're going to munch on your brownie that you think is which will eventually kill you.
Right. Such a great litmus test. And for managers out there or business owners there, they should probably be asking themselves that tough question of do my people feel free to talk about what might be a turd on the table when I'm telling them it's a brownie? So there's another chapter about one of my favorite topics, which is about change and people's reaction to change. And you remind people that the reality is that change, for the most part, really sucks. And what's also interesting is that you write that 70% of all organizational change initiatives fail, including mergers and acquisitions and introductions of new technology and changes in business processes. So somewhat related to turds, Rashad, explain why the concept of the human colon is so helpful in managing change or eliciting change.
So one of the key parts is that I explain to people is that when people tell me change is good, I tell them, I'm happy, why don't you change? And I find it extraordinary that people come to you telling you something is good, but they want you to do it, mm-hmm. right? And my belief is, hey, listen, I've worked for the same company for 38 years. I've basically been married to a lady who I met 48 years ago. And so I actually hate change. So if you like it so much, why don't you go do it?
Right. And you've worked at this same company for many years. It's really remarkable that you,
right.
Because you seem a bit like a troublemaker.
Yeah, and I've worked for the two bosses who are the leaders of the company for the last 25 years. And they both sort of, you know, either retired on me or they decided to run away, whatever.
Well, well played, good sir.
Yeah, but the key simply is that change is very difficult for human beings because when we have to change, we don't know what we're doing. And when we don't know what we're doing, we make a fool of ourselves. And the more senior we are, the less we want to make a fool of ourselves, because if we make a fool of ourselves, our peers basically either take away a job or we don't look so good. So we start pretending. And so while I do believe change sucks, I also believe irrelevance is even worse.
Yes.
And so what I try to let people know is if you are trying to drive change in an organization, you must recognize that while the world is digital, silicon, and data-driven, human beings happen to be analog, carbon-based, and feeling-filled. And as a result, you have to A, let them know that change is difficult, and you have to plan that change will take more time than you normally would expect. Second is you need to incentivize change, which is pay people to change. If you want new behaviors, you want a new organization, you want a new line of work, pay people more to do that line of work than the existing line of work, even though the existing line of work is much more profitable and productive. Because if you don't, people will follow incentive plans. They're not going to follow change memos, which is sort of the second. And the third one, to a great extent, is you must provide a lot of training and you must provide a lot of recognition besides even financial incentives to the people who change. If you don't, all you're basically telling people is you should change, but when you change, you will make a fool of yourself, but you won't be paid more. We won't educate you. We won't support you. Who in their right mind, excepting an idiot, would do that?
Well, somebody who's working for an organization that has got them very, very fearful.
Yes. And then it's a pretend change. You know, what I call is there is the change of rituals and the change of meaning. The change of rituals is when you do M&A and you put out decks and you use words like platform and personalization and disruption. And I've seen so many people talk about that. And I say, okay, let's suppose if I remove all these six or seven, you know, buzzword bingo from your deck and from your conversation, do you have anything really worthwhile to say?
So just to make sure we don't leave the listener hanging as it relates to this discussion of turds and colon, let me quote from the book. Discuss the colon, not the punctuation mark, but the body part. Given my previous metaphor, turd on the table, you may think I'm digestive system obsessed, but this is too good a related metaphor to pass up. The temptation is to focus on positive outcomes of transformation. The cost savings, the gain in market share, the increased speed of digital tools. In other words, the cool stuff that emerges from the change. But savvy transformers recognize that employees require a discussion of the unattractive process that eventually produces great outcomes. This discussion demonstrates that management understands and empathizes with the difficulties accompanying change. Discussing the colon means looking at the journey of transformation from start to finish, setting up the signposts, and marking progress. Pardon the pun, but people are much more willing to go along with change when they're reassured that things will work out in the end. So you talked earlier about story, and you mentioned that. I want to ask you about what you describe as unleashing creativity by inserting poetry into the PowerPoint. And you write specifically that a sure sign that a company is capable of right brain as well as left brain thinking is the ability to tell a story. And I may be the only one, but I think there's a lot of confusion about what that means, perhaps from a more practical standpoint. What, sure. What does that mean?
So what that means is the following. The first is, you know, the chapter really is about the fact that I believe that the ultimate entrepreneurs and the most innovative people, or the ultimate entrepreneurs, happen to be artists. So if you think of a writer, they start with a blank sheet of paper, or a painter, blank sheet of paper, or a sculptor with a block of wood, or a playwright with an empty stage, right? You always, and then you invent things. And that's one thing. So I always basically say, if people want to learn about innovation, they should visit museums, listen to music, go to a play, because that's number one. Number two is, if you want to convince people to do new things, often what we do in presentations without us knowing it is we actually bring into help us art. We run YouTube videos, we show cartoons, we look at pictures. But third and most importantly, if you start thinking about companies that are very, very famous and they basically try to start even before their products and services are ready, try to tell a story about why they are unique. So think about Steve Jobs coming back with Think Different, right? Mm-hmm. The products at that stage were colored different, but they were not significantly different. But he came back with sort of, you know, Think Different, which was important. And so you want to tell people, hey, this company, this product, or this service actually fits in your life and solves a human thing. And my belief is, I use this quote from Joan Didion, the famous essayist, which is, we tell ourselves stories in order to live. We make sense of our day-to-day through a narrative, right? So many people today are making sense on or trying to figure out, why did they not, or why did they actually sell, let's say, equities if they had any 20 days ago or did not, right? So they're trying to say, why did I do this? Why did I not do this? And they aren't doing it through data. They're basically doing it through storytelling. And so my belief is, if you cannot tell me a story about where you are, where are you going, where did you come from, where are you going, right? I don't know exactly what you are. And including as a, not only as an individual, but as a company. Because if a company talks about, let's say, here is the utility of what I do. So my product satisfies this function. My product is priced like this. My product is available like this. And my product has these components. That's interesting, but not differentiating. If on the other hand, you basically say, the history of my company is here. The purpose and values of my company is I want to organize the world's information, right? Mm-hmm. Versus, hey, I run an algorithm that points to the page most cited. Right. That's different.
Yeah, and that's what probably all of them do now. So it's not really a differentiator either.
No, but what basically happens is at some particular stage, some of them have become so big, they then take away some of the, you know, like for instance, a company we know no longer uses the word, let's not be evil.
Right.
Okay. And so these things sort of basically change. And, you know, sometimes the reason that they're taking it up is when you put up a purpose, value, story, people hold you to it. And they hold you to that much more than they basically hold you to the utility of your business.
Right. So moving on, you have a chapter about upgrading your mental operating system, which I think a lot of listeners to at least this podcast and others are doing. Just by listening in and learning. And you write that when companies speak about growth, they need to move beyond the growth of financial numbers that can be captured in a spreadsheet and toward the growth of the people who work for them. They need to think about the story of growth. As much as personal and professional growth is an individual responsibility, leadership can do a lot to stimulate this development. Like what?
There are a lot of things that leadership can basically do to help people sort of grow. There are some which I basically call very broadly things that the atmosphere of the company. So one which I've mentioned earlier is the ability for people to speak up. Second is to have companies that have a sense of balance, which is, hey, listen, let's not be so extreme and think we're just cows that have to be basically milked. But as importantly, you want to give people the ability to grow their own minds. So one of the chapters in my book is how to upgrade your mental operating system. One of the reasons why we are struggling in organizations is the world is moving forward much faster than we are. And as a result, we sometimes fall behind. Now, one of the ways we try to stay alive and alert in the physical world is we try to figure out what we're eating and how much we're exercising. We don't spend as much time at what we're putting in our minds and how we are using our minds, which is what I call the mental operating system. Mm-hmm. And for me, when companies basically, A, create an environment where people can speak up, where they provide you with some sort of training, including maybe the ability to go see the arts and museums, etc. Third is they basically say, hey, look, whenever you are thinking about something, you should try to build a case for the exact opposite. And only if you can build a case for what you are recommending as well as for the opposite of what you're recommending, do you actually know and can you actually grow?
And that concept you put in an essay to help get your first job at Leo Burnett, is that right?
Yes, it is actually probably the only reason besides my striking good looks that
yes,
got me the job.
I was going to mention that, yes, because you are not an unattractive man, despite what you said earlier.
Right. So it was basically that was what did it. And in the early days of Leo Burnett, or in the many years ago, not the early days, but when I applied.
Like 83 or 82.
82 too. In addition to basically having your resume, they wanted you to write an essay. You selected what the topic was and you wrote it. It's sort of like if you think about, you know, college entry or college admission. And the person who was interviewing you had to basically read the essay and they read your resume. And my essay stood out because it was so unique that you have to build a case for the exact opposite. And I didn't realize how unique it was till about 5 years ago, which was 33 years after I had started there. I met one of the people who had interviewed me, and his name was Russ Klein, is Russ Klein. And among the things, you know, he's been the chief marketing officer of Burger King, and now he's the chief
executive. Is he also the president of the AMA now?
He's now the president of the AMA.
Yes, I've met him.
Right,
yeah.
Now, he was the head of a 7-Up. And we were sitting at dinner, and he says, you know, he said, I'll never forget, even though it's been 20 years since I've worked at Burnett, every time I see you, I remember that essay, because that essay stood out and the reason we hired you.
Wow. That's terrific. So, Rashad, what are some of the different online resources that you've used over the years to enhance your skills and learn at your own pace?
So one of the biggest things that I do is in the course of every day, whether I am listening to people or overhearing people or reading, say, a newspaper or magazine, whenever I come across something that I'm not sure about or I'd like to know more about, I basically put it down on my phone's notes app. And then I wake up every morning at 4:30 when I'm either in Chicago or New York and spend an hour and a half learning and investigating the things that I have on this, which I wanted to know more about but did not understand. Mm. So one of the key things I do is I keep a year out for things either I'd like to know more about because they sound interesting or people are talking about and I have no clue what they're talking about, right?
Yeah.
But being too shy to ask, like, what the hell this is, I have the Library of Alexandria because I have a web browser and I go check it out. And somewhere between Google search and Wikipedia and something, I'll know something about it. That's one. But in addition, I basically have a number of advisors without them knowing that they're my advisors. So in my Twitter handle, which is at Rashad, I have a number of lists. These lists are everything from people that I follow on topics like finance, technology, advertising, marketing, society. I obviously follow journalists who are very opinionated. I follow comics. I know you're a comic. Maybe I should follow you in the comic section, right?
We'll see how I turn out. Yeah.
Just funny. So what I also basically believe for the very, you know, yes, a lot of social media can be distractive, toxic, etc., but used properly, it can be intense. I also, what I do is I use Evernote to, whenever I read and I come across something good, I capture it on Evernote. I use Feedly, which is the way I sort of browse through streams of information. So I subscribe to a lot of different feeds on Feedly. And I most recently, for the last couple of years, particularly intensely the last year, have been a big believer in podcasts. So when I'm either in my car or in the gym or walking on the streets of Chicago, I listen to podcasts and I basically have a number of them that I follow. Everything from ones that are very well known, like, say, Pivot with Kara Swisher and Professor Galloway, to the most amazing podcast about, if you wanted to learn about how television is made, on what I consider today the one of the best television shows being made, which is called the Better Saul Call podcast, which is a podcast by the creators of Better Call Saul, which includes the showrunners, the editors, right, on how each episode is put together. And it's not about like what happens in the episode, but how did they do what we saw or heard in that episode.
Yeah. Okay?
It is absolutely extraordinary. So I do all these different things, you know. And so as a combination of all these tools, which I have listed in my book, it allows me to continuously learn and try to continuously upgrade my mental operating system, which then makes me remain relevant, or at least pretend to be relevant, and don't get thrown out.
Yes, yes, I understand that completely. And I came from this ad background. And within 10 years ago, I started to notice, I'm sure after you did, that things were changing. And I really didn't feel like I was growing dinosaur scales. And I think that that's part of what ultimately led to this podcast, which keeps me reading books and talking to people and doing that sort of thing. Now, what we will do for the listener is that your episode show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com, we're going to include links to those Twitter lists so they can find them.
Perfect. Quickly.
And you're going to be added to a Twitter list, which I have, which we'll include a link to, of all guests on the Marketing Book Podcast, which is a very long and interesting list. I'll also include a link to Evernote and Feedly. I use Feedly, and a lot of people don't seem to know about that. And I also think Feedly is very, very helpful for salespeople who want to check it every morning and see if there's something interesting that they can then send to a prospect that adds value, rather than saying, hey, I haven't heard from you in a couple months. Do you want to buy yet? That sort
yes,
of thing.
So exactly.
Just two other quick questions about the book before we wrap up. This is of particular interest to me, and I think it's worth repeating in every episode. And you wrote that most companies talk about the importance of listening to customers, but in some organizations, it is more than talk. What are some of the successful companies doing to make this happen and effective?
There are a lot of successful companies, but there are two behaviors that people do. One is the senior management of the company makes sure that they spend at least a day every month going and listening to either if they have a customer line, not only listening to it, but answering questions. But as importantly, going out to stores, if they're selling through a store or a restaurant, and actually serving customers and listening to customers, which is extremely important. These people, what they also basically do is they ask for email and letters from customers, and not necessarily, hey, just show me, you know, a few. It's like, why don't you randomly select 50? And if you have read it, what I need are the 20, the one that complain the most. Okay. So what you want to basically do is get a random 50, so you have an idea of what's going on, and then you specifically look at the ones that are complaining the most, because the ones that are complaining the most may actually give you a sign of something. So even though, for instance, Amazon is a very data-driven company, what Jeff Bezos apparently does is he looks for anecdotes, and then he looks to see if data supports the anecdotes. So he hears from people, and then he asks questions, data-driven questions, to see if the data supports it. He doesn't just look at the data and say, this is what it says.
Right. Just like we talked about earlier, I thought that was very interesting. He's fascinated by the anecdotes first.
Yes.
Then,
yes,
of course, you know, looks at the data. One other thing I want to ask you about is towards the end of the book, you remind readers that we can't lose community. And you write that people are looking for work to provide a sense of community as never before. My sense is that that word, community, is widely misunderstood, or it means different things to different people. What does community mean, really, in that context?
To me, the single biggest part of community, and it's a sort of the chapter called, you know, Robots Compute, People Dream, is we as human beings have always wanted to connect with each other. And to be community is the ability to connect with other human beings to do one of three things. One is to connect with other human beings in order to learn and understand human beings, which is number one, right? Mm-hmm. The second is to basically grow and be less lonely. And third is to actually get new ideas. You know, one of the, if you remember many, many years ago, when you had modern internet computing and sort of the stuff that you and I are doing right now, which is we're speaking over the internet. If we wanted, we could be looking at each other over the internet. Which we did at the beginning of the conversation.
But I spare my guests having to look at me. Yes.
Yes, and you know, for a second or two that I saw you, I thought of like disconnecting from Skype, but I decided that since I'd signed on, I had to take pity on you.
My listeners and I appreciate your bravery and diligence.
Absolutely, but the key there is this, which is, despite all of these technologies, you would sort of expect that the United States would become a place where the urban centers would hollow out. But instead, in the last 10 years, the cities have basically become more and more populated. Mm-hmm. Because people are looking for community. It's one of the reasons that the concept of WeWork was right. While the financials of WeWork were wrong, the concept, which is at some particular stage, even if you are a freelancer, if you are an artist, if you are a writer, you want to be with other people, even if it is sitting in the corner of a coffee shop.
Mm-hmm. So true. Yeah, look at any of those coffee shops. And if anyone's never been to one of those co-working spaces, go visit one. It's so interesting to immerse yourself there, even for just a few minutes, to observe what's going on. Despite what people say, they want to be with other people. They want to learn from them, and they want to get ideas. So, Rashad, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
I would basically say that the thing that I hope they would take away is that you are only as good as how much you improve yourself and how much you improve the people around you. That you can only be a superstar if you have stars around you, because then as they shine, people will say, who are they reflecting off? So if you want to build your own reputation, your own career, it's very important to build those around you. Early on, to build your bosses, later on, to build your colleagues and bosses, and then as you get later on, to build your teams, colleagues and bosses, is one very big thing, which is your success is built on the people around you, because sooner or later, going solo won't actually work outside of one or two or three professions, like maybe a writer or something like that. The second, which is a component of this about growth, is not only do you have to grow people around you, but you want to grow continuously as a human being. And one way of doing that is try to take an hour every day to learn new things, meet new people, have new experiences. Because the days you stop doing that, you are repeating things. You're no longer living.
Wise words. Very well said. What is one thing a listener could do today to put in action an idea from your book, if not the one you just mentioned about spend an hour learning something new?
What I would basically do is I would say to do the following thing. Try to basically build a case for the exact opposite of what you most recently recommended to your boss or to anybody else.
Excellent.
Build a case why you were completely wrong. And if you do that well, this book will be useful and this conversation will have helped you.
Oh, great. Great advice. So, Rashad, what books have inspired your working career?
So, many books have inspired me, but the one that probably set me on a marketing career was a textbook called, I believe, either Elements of Marketing or Principles of Marketing by a gentleman called Philip Kotler, who is now an emeritus professor here at Northwestern, and I got to basically meet him. And when I read that book, I got fixated about marketing, and he has a definition, which is marketing is about understanding and meeting customer requirements. And then for the first 15 years of my marketing life, I realized we weren't doing it till something came called the internet, when then we were forced to do it, because now all of a sudden customers had power.
That's great. I've had the honor of interviewing him twice, and his book is just still a bestseller. I think it's somewhere between the 15th and 20th edition.
Yes.
Came out in the late 60s, I believe. Yes. So are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or are looking forward to seeing?
So there are a bunch of books that I've recently got a hold of, which are, I think, very interesting and provide sort of unique perspectives. So one is many of us who are in business find ourselves traveling often. And I'm sure we will return to traveling once the current crisis passes. Mm-hmm. And there is this very unusual book called Flights, F-L-I-G-H-T-S, Flights, by a lady called Olga Tokarczuk. So it's just if you do Flights and Olga. And it came out a few years ago, but it only has come out in English this year. And Olga basically has won the Nobel Prize. And this particular book basically won the Man Booker Prize. And it's basically sort of a meditation on travel, including like, it's a book about noticing. She notices airports and stories and, you know, ferry lines and things like that. So it sort of makes you think, you know, interestingly. And then there are a couple of books, one from some gentlemen from McKinsey, which is called Strategy Beyond the Hockey Stick, and how to keep people in mind and probabilities when you decide how to create a strategy, which I find interesting. And for those who are interested in trends, it's been around for a while, but I recently got it. It's come on paperback. It's called Non-Obvious Megatrends by Rohit Bhargava. And those are, you know, some of the sort of the non-fiction oriented books. Mm-hmm. And for fiction, I believe probably one of the best writers today is a lady by the name of Zadie Smith, who became very famous for a book called White Teeth. But she has recently, she's actually even better than being a writer of non-fiction, is she's an amazing essayist. And she's put together a book of essays, which are absolutely amazing. And they're prescient. So in she had an essay that she wrote 7 years ago or 6 years ago on Facebook. And if you read it today, it's basically like she knew the future.
Is that her book, Feel Free Essays?
Yes, yes, okay. Zadie Smith.
Interesting, yes. And the other books, I've looked them up while you're talking, Strategy Beyond the Hockey Stick, People, Probabilities, and Big Moves to Beat the Odds.
Yes.
And Rohit's book was featured on the Marketing Book Podcast. And for the last several years, as he updated that book every year, he was always the first guest on the show each year. Just fascinating. And this one, I don't know that he's going to update it every year now, but just fascinating. And he came to mind as you were talking about how you'll notice things and yes. you'll want to learn about them. That's exactly, he spends every day of the year curating all these trends. It's just yes. fascinating. I hope he doesn't stop doing that.
No. And he looks at these meta trends and he puts them into different places. And in fact, I sort of found his book very useful. And, you know, I spent a lot of my time reading on all kinds of things. And, you know, and the one thing that I do, which is still completely analog. So while I have gone digital in my music and obviously streaming on TV, and I read all my newspapers on my iPad, the place that I am completely analog remains books, and therefore they occupy space, which my wife kind of looks at and says, why do you have to keep all these books? And I said, because A, it makes me feel learned, and B, when I look at them, I remember it and I can pull something, and it's easier than it being on Kindle.
Yes, I agree completely, and I'm glad to find a kindred spirit. All the books that are on the podcast, I have to have the author send me a hard copy because I mark it up, and I'm pretty sure there's all kinds of science that shows about how you absorb the information differently in a book versus reading it on a screen. I think we scan more than absorb it.
Yeah, and you know what is very particularly telling, by the way, there's a statistic. So for instance, as you know, there are actually more audible books than Kindle books that are usually sold for any particular book. And for many books, the audible book is between 10 and 20% of all the books sold as we become more of a voice-driven society. Mm-hmm. Not surprisingly, in my particular case, the audible number of books is less than 2%. And the reason is because if you've read my book, which you have, most people, after they read my book, I say, can I see it? And it's highly marked up. And it's very hard to mark up Audible.
Yes. And I have only listened to one audiobook ever. And it was Joe Polizzi's Mystery, that it came out in audio first. So I had to listen to that, and it was a very different experience from what I'm used to. But for your book, I'm able to go back and see all the things I've marked up. And yes, that's interesting, and I still have them. They're all here in the office. This office is starting to look like a secondhand bookshop, and I make no apologies for that. So
all you have to do is serve some coffee, have some flowers, and that'll be a new business for you.
Yes, yes. Well, that's not a bad idea, and I could probably build further community. It's even
better than that. You can call it Doug's Den and serve single malt scotch at very expensive prices.
Yes. Well, we're going to have to keep talking after this interview is over. I like where this is going, right. Mr. Tabakawala. So at marketingbookpodcast.com, like I mentioned earlier, we're going to include links to your site and, well, to your company's site and to your social media and the list that we mentioned and your LinkedIn profile and so forth. I hope folks will, you know, reach out and thank you for being a guest on the show. And for you, dear listener, if you are listening on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on the show notes link. The name of the book is Restoring the Soul of Business, Staying Human in the Age of Data. The author is Rashad Tabakawala. Rashad, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me and for your listeners to bearing up with both of us.
And that closes the book on episode 276 of the Marketing Book Podcast. For more, check out this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. And if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or other helpful resource for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat and I'll try to point you in the right direction. My name again is Douglas Burdett. And if you'd like to record a question that could be played and answered on a future episode, please go to marketingbookpodcast.com and record it. And please join us next time as we welcome back Robbie Kelman Baxter to talk about her new book, The Forever Transaction, how to build a subscription model so compelling your customers will never want to leave. Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast. This episode was produced by Jessica Ambrose.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.